Hello, friends. Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots. Tate Duryea and Ryan Gibson in the house. What's up, Ryan?
Not much.
We're talking taxes today. I can't. I'm cutting you off because I'm so excited. Toby Mathis is back, baby.
He's back. And so much has changed this year, and we're going to talk about it.
Yeah. Toby was on episodes 10 and 14. We've been referring people back to episodes 10 and 14 since we started the show because they were our most downloaded episodes. They're awesome. I mean, Toby is just, he's so good and he makes taxes so interesting that we've been just dying to have him back on. We finally have him today.
And here's why you want to listen to this episode. Number one, we're going to talk about all the things that you need to do by the end of the year if you want to save on taxes. We're going to air this in November. So that means that if you're listening right now in November, there are steps and action items that you need to take to save taxes. The other thing that we're going to do is we're going to break out the things that you don't necessarily have to do this year to save on taxes, and maybe you can wait till next year. And the biggest takeaway from this episode was if you're giving to charities, if you're donating, there's a much better strategy than just doing it every year a little bit. And Toby just blew my mind on a strategy on how to do this in a way that, A, you can give and give a lot and give a much better tax efficiency with it. Stay around for that. That applies to everybody, whether you're doing real estate or not doing real estate or how you're investing. So really awesome episode.
Once again, I mean, we say this all the time, but you know, don't show up to your CPA on April 1st and say, help me. You got to take action before the end of the year. You got to change your facts to change your tax, right? So you have to put some strategies in play. You got to move some stuff around before the end of the year to take advantage of some of the tax benefits. The Big Beautiful Bill came out this year. Lots of benefits in that in terms of 100% bonus depreciation and ways that you can offset capital gains, income. So I think people are going to get a ton out of this episode.
Yeah. And by the way, at the end and in the show notes, if you want to meet Toby and you want to connect, he's actually going to have an event in December that you can go to, and we'll put a link to the show notes on that. So if you want to learn more about this stuff, set up tax and legal stuff, December 4th through the 6th, I go every quarter to these. I will put a link in the show, and the first 10 or so people that hit me up about it, I can give you guys a free ticket.
Where is it?
It's in Dallas, Texas. It's December 4th through the 6th, and I'm going to be there with my team. I'm going to be talking about self-storage. Toby and Clint and the whole Anderson group are going to be talking about tax and legal planning and things like that. So with that, let's get into it.
Let's get to the show.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Welcome back, everybody, to Passive Income Pilots. This is Ryan, joined here with Toby. Toby, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic, Ryan.
Thanks for coming back onto the show. You've been on the show, I think, now 3 or 4 times. And today what we're going to do is we're going to be talking about year-end tax tips, right? We're getting in that October timeframe, maybe even November now when this airs. And we want to know the things that we can do as pilots and aviators to position ourselves best by things that need to be done by the end of the year, but also things that we can also still do next year. So we're going to kind of break that apart. All right. So Toby, first of all, before we get into it, for those that haven't heard of you or have you have watched your YouTube channels or attended your conferences or things like that, you know, just tell me a little bit about who you are.
Yeah, I guess for most people, they're going to look at me and say tax attorney, but what I am is a derelict investor who likes investing in all sorts of things. And I kind of look at it like a mad scientist lab, and I look at what works and what doesn't. I love to share it. And that's been my thing for the last probably 10, 15 years, is really breaking down information and sharing what works and what doesn't with people out there. Cause there's just nowadays every TikTok influencer is giving out advice, and you got to know what's real and what's not.
Yeah, totally. And I think what a lot of people have benefited from, I mean, you have hundreds of thousands of views on your videos. You've advised tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of clients on the best way to do their tax and legal structuring. You know, they've really benefited from that. And I think, you know, as we get to the end of 2025, you know, there is the time is running out to do some things to take advantage of some gains that maybe people have had in the year and sort of how they can offset them through investment activity. You know, I wanted to really dive into that with you today. I mean, what are some things that investors should be thinking about? And, you know, our investors are investing in alternatives. They're investing in real estate. They're investing in stocks, bonds, mutual funds, crypto, or considering it. So you really have, you know, every tool on the table from that perspective. Some people that might be listening to this are just passive investors or looking mm-hmm. for passive losses or experiencing passive gains because they're working a full-time W-2 job, making, you know, $300,000 to $500,000 a year. And then there might be an occasional real estate professional listening to this that may be able to take advantage of that. But where would you kind of start with things that people could do between now and then?
Wow. So there's, I'm going to make some assumptions here. So, you know, for most of your folks, I assume they're going to be accredited investors, which means that they're making pretty good money. They're probably in that 32% tax bracket, right? And they're getting hit and they're kind of tired of the pain, right? And they actually have a pretty strong motivation to do tax planning. If I'm wrong about that assumption, if somebody is in the $100,000 range a year, then their incentive isn't quite as high, right? So some of these things they might say, hey, that seems like a lot of bother. But no, for someone who federal tax 32 plus their employment taxes, which can be as high as 15.3%. It's like, again, there's these huge chunks that they take out of us. Then you have your state tax, which can be up into 13%, depending on where you live. You know, for some of your listeners, they're in the 40 to 50% tax bracket. So they have a strong incentive to do a little bit of tax planning. And the things that I tend to look at over and over again, especially with real estate investors, is do we want to accelerate some of the deductions that we would normally spread out over many years and take them this year? Do we want to find a way to jam that in? Or do we have an incentive to do, let's just say, repairs and or fixing up and doing a rehab? And by the way, under the One Big Beautiful Bill, a lot of folks may not realize this, but if you have non-residential property, so if you are not a long-term landlord, like you're not buying residential property and just passively leasing it out, but if you're doing things like storage, if you're doing things like VRBO and Airbnb, those are non-residential. Then you have something called QIP, which is qualified improvement property, where you can do fix up on that. And if you do a cost seg and break it down into its pieces, you could write off 100% of that rehab on those properties this year. Even if you bought the property 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 1 year ago, it doesn't really matter. It's when you do that rehab. So there's all these things that are giving us these incentives. And we say, hey, you know, if I could put another $20,000 in that property, what if I had a tax break because of that that gave me 40% of that back? So I'm getting a really good deal to do these. And that's how taxes kind of motivate us. So that being said, there's a lot of misunderstanding out there about what you have to do in order to accelerate some of these things and then how I can use some of those losses. So let me give you an example. Residential property, maybe I'm doing syndications and I have this passive loss and you think there's nothing I can do with that. I heard that I can only use passive losses against passive income. Yeah, to a certain extent. There are things like when you sell a property, it releases and it becomes ordinary loss. If you're grouping it with your business, your self-leasing, you could use that loss against your business income. If you're a real estate professional, then it's non-passive loss and you can use it against your W-2 and other income sources. If you do short-term rentals, and we call it the short-term rental loophole, it can be non-passive loss. It could be ordinary loss that comes out and you can use it against your other income sources, including your W-2 income. If you're an active participant in real estate and you're below a certain threshold of income, which is below $150,000 a year, then you can use some of these losses. There might be a limit up to $25,000, but these things are out there that allow you to use them. So a lot of people will just blanketly say, oh, I can't use the passive. You might be able to. There might be a lot of scenarios, or you may be able to use that passive loss against things you didn't realize. For example, if I sell a property and it was a passive property, that's passive capital gains. I can use my passive loss to offset it. So if I am leaving a syndication where, you know, we're doing a liquidation event and I'm buying another, there's a good chance that the loss that I could create from buying another will offset the gain that I had on the exit. And people do not realize this. And if they did, then they might do planning differently. So for example, coming up to the end of the year, and if I have a passive gain, I'm sitting there, I exited, and I have $100,000 that's going to hit me. And I'm thinking, ah, it's not too bad. It's long-term capital gains or whatnot. Well, wouldn't it be nice to not have to pay tax on that? All you have to do is invest in another property, which you're going to do anyway. Maybe now you have an incentive to do it before the end of the year. That's all. And it's just looking at that and saying, hey, these things are available to me. There's a ton of others. I mean, I could just throw darts at you all day. But for your folks, I just wanted to say, here's the assumption that there might be in some tax pain. Then let's talk about the low-lying fruit. And one of the first ones is accelerating the deduction into that first year. We have this 100% bonus depreciation. We have 100% deductions for qualified improvement property. We have safe harbors for repairs that, can be done, and you know, things that you do on a property that could create a deduction. And then we have more exuberant stuff like, hey, can I be a real estate professional? Can I get my spouse to qualify? Unlock all those passive laws? Could I do the short-term rental loophole? Could I do all these things before the end of the year? Those are the, kind of the big ones.
And Toby, before we kind of go too much further, I know there's people that are tuning in and they're like, what the heck is he talking about? I've never invested in real estate before. I just did a syndication with you, Ryan, or somebody else this year. What are we talking about here for just a second? And the thing that we wanted to educate you on is, if you invest in a syndication of real estate, then you get a K-1 typically in the first year for that syndication that gives you tax efficiency. And the reason why I'd say tax efficiency is because some people confuse depreciation losses that you get with something bad that's happening to the property. And it's not bad. It's just you get a K-1 that's going to have a depreciable loss. I believe it's in box 2 of your K-1 where you get it and there's going to be a big, huge loss. And some investors go, well, what do I even do with that? Can I deduct that against my Delta income or my W-2 income that's not real estate related? The answer is no. But then they say, well, what can I use it against? Well, I can use it against other gains that I've had that are considered passive activity, like owning a rental property or selling a rental property or owning another piece of real estate or selling another piece of real estate or having some type of passive loss. And all Toby did a really good job of explaining is that there could be other things as well in addition to that, depending on your activity as well. I just wanted to make that available to our investors. And then he mentioned very briefly the notion of being a real estate professional and being able to deduct that. And there's some certain fields or professions and time that you can spend in certain real estate activities, like being a real estate agent or a developer or owning a significant portion of a real estate company, that if you're doing that, then you can actually deduct all of it against the earned income that you have, or if you're married to somebody who does something like that. So I just wanted to make sure those that are like listening to us, like, what the heck is going on? You know, we've got a good baseline for those folks as well.
Yeah. Taxes are not necessarily straightforward. And the easiest way to think about this is I always use Orlando, flying into Orlando Airport as an example. And I want to say, like, if you're going to Disney World, so you fly into Orlando Airport and you get a rental car and you're driving to Disney World, there's a lot of signs that'll take you to Disney World. But they will put you onto not the freeway, but the tollway. And you'll end up paying tolls to get to Disney World. Whereas there's another path, Sand Lake Road is the first exit right out of there. They have a number for it, but we used to always just call it Sand Lake Road. And you just drive on the surface streets and it takes you right to Disney World and you avoid all the tolls. And that's the tax system in a nutshell. There's the easy way, which is just to do nothing and just to kind of follow the signs, pay this now, pay this exorbitant amount. Okay. And yeah, you'll get to your destination. But there's another world out there, which is for those who have a little bit of knowledge that says, hey, I can avoid that. And, you know, again, just talking about a Delta pilot who's having some passive income off of a syndication, here's an incentive for you. You're always, the old adage is, if you're paying tax on real estate, it's because you don't own enough. If you have a situation where you are starting to see taxable income hit your return because you have syndications, then you should be buying more syndications that accelerate their depreciation. And the reason I'm saying this is because normally you buy a property, the IRS says you get to write off a certain amount every year, If it's residential, it's 127.5. If it's commercial or non-residential, it's 39 years, so it's 139th. For the improvement on the property, not the land. You never get to write off the land. So just looking at that, you're saying, gosh, that's a long period of time. What I'm talking about is saying, hey, that's the toll road. The other road is you do what's called a cost segregation, and you break that property into its 5-year, 7-year, 15-year property along with the 39 or the 27 and a half, whether if it's residential. And we accelerate a bunch of that deduction, which is usually about 30 to 40% of it, into the first year. And you can do that now if you buy a property after January 19th of 2025 and put it into service. You get 100% bonus depreciation. If you do improvements, it could be 100% qualified improvement property. If you do repairs, it could be 100% deduction. Like, all these things are kind of floating around out there and people don't know they exist. Now, I can say this because I've worked with you guys for so long. Spartan understands it. And Spartan creates that loss that Ryan is talking about, but it is a paper loss. If I have a pizza shop and I buy a pizza oven, I'm going to write that whole thing off in the first year. But if I buy a property, if I buy a storage, self-storage facility, I'm supposed to write that off over 39 years. But the pizza guy got to write off his oven in 1 year. Well, the pizza guy had 5-year property. So we just need to say, what portion of the property that you bought is 5-year, 7-year, 15-year property? And by the way, all those qualify for 100% bonus depreciation in the first year. Boom. Huge deduction. Now, what can I use it for? Well, if you have rents hitting your return from other properties or other syndications, that loss will keep you from having to pay tax on it. It'll offset it. A lot of people don't realize. They just look at it, oh, it's passive loss, I can't use it. No, you can use it against other passive income. If you are a silent owner, and by the way, I know a lot of pilots are, in side businesses, and they do not materially participate in that business, let's say it's a McDonald's, let's say it's a Subway, let's say it's a pizza shop, that's passive. Let's say you're in an S corp with your nephew on a pizza shop, and it's kicking out income, and you're like, I'm not working for it. That's passive income, which means when I buy a syndication, it creates passive loss. I can offset that income. That's why rich people are always saying, I don't want to participate. I just want to be passive in these deals. And they invest in lots of different ventures because they realize at the end of the day, with the real estate loss, I could avoid having to pay tax on a bunch of other income that I have coming in. But if that's not getting you where you need to go, there's ways to unlock that passive loss and make it non-passive. And that's where you get into active participation, real estate professional grouping, short-term rental loophole. Those could unlock it. And then let's say that you're a Delta pilot making $500,000 a year. You could create $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 of loss that offsets that income. And all of a sudden, you're no longer in the 32% tax bracket, my friend. You're sitting there in the 12% tax bracket. Right? The 20%.
Yeah. So what Toby is, you know, to kind of break this down, right? He said a lot there. And I just want to make sure that those that are hearing this for the first time really understand this. He said that you can 139th a property when you buy it in depreciation. That gives you a tax benefit every year. So here's an easy example that I hope we can all do in our heads here. You buy a $400,000 self-storage facility. And let's just say that the land is worth $10,000. So you have $390,000 left to allocate. You get a $10,000 deduction for 39 years. That's called straight line depreciation. So Spartan typically bought a property and did absolutely nothing except take the toll road. We would get a $10,000 a year loss. That's what we would get for 39 years. Not that attractive. But what we do is we go out and we hire a cost segregation study company. And we actually put it into service, or we actually break down the components. And Toby basically compared that to a pizza oven, right? Well, at a self-storage facility, your 5-year life, and correct me if I'm wrong under these, Toby, like 5-year lives would be things like latches, light bulbs, doors, fencing, landscaping, you know, things in the office, like TVs.
Landscaping would probably be 15-year, but do you have land?
15-year, yeah.
Things like that.
And the reality is the cost segregation expert's going to go to the property, take pictures of how the thing is constructed, and they're going to break out all those components and put them into a big bucket. And that big bucket's basically going to say that you can write those things off in the first year. So instead of having $390,000 to write off over 30 years, now we might have, say, $125,000 to write off in the first year. And then whatever is left over, we can still write off over 39 years. So as an investor, when you get your K-1, here's what you're expecting to see. And that first year that we bought that property, you're expecting to see a nice loss in your box two and your K-1. In subsequent years, there'll be a little bit of a loss, but not one that outstrips your distributions most likely. So what that means, and Toby said, you know, hey, if you do absolutely nothing, you're still going to get this paper loss. What that really means is that, okay, so if I put my money into a Spartan deal and I do no other deals, I'm going to get the paper loss. And so when those distributions come out, my understanding, Toby, is you can use the huge loss you got in the first year and sort of shield those taxable distributions.
It carries forward. So let's say that I invest in a deal and it's giving me $30,000 of distributions every year. And I have a $100,000 massive loss in the first year. And every year I have an extra $15,000 of loss. I'm just kind of throwing numbers out there. You would still get the $15,000 every year. That $100,000 would keep the, let's say it's 30 and you have 15 that's already being offset. So you have $15,000 of taxable income. You just wouldn't be paying any tax on that extra 15 for the next 8 years. You know, so it's not a bad thing. It's I'm not going to pay tax and those passive losses will continue going forward.
Yeah. And the other part of it too, that Toby talked about that I thought was so critical was if you've sold one of your rental properties this year, your commercial building, or maybe a syndication sold this year and you got your return of capital, you can invest in another investment, like another syndication with real estate, and it'll offset the gain that you've had from that sale. So you might be talking to your CPA right now and they're saying, hey, so what did you make on that deal? Oh, okay. Well, you're going to have this much gain on that investment. And then you might be coming to Spartan and saying, hey, you know, what do you guys have that I can use for depreciation? And then we can give you an investment that gets you into those depreciable losses that will shield your gain from paying taxes on this. And obviously, if you're not invested with us and, you know, you're doing your own rental properties, maybe you sold something and bought something, you know, you can start doing that math to see if what you gain is offset by what you bought. And these are conversations you should be actively having with your CPA as well.
They call that the lazy man's 1031, by the way.
Yes.
Like it's not a secret. It's just unless you're with an accountant that knows real estate, they may miss it. And there's a few of them that they miss. The qualified improvement property, that's a big one that they seem to miss all the time. Cost segregation confuses the heck out of them. They don't understand real estate professional status for the most part. They don't understand the loopholes. They don't understand grouping sometimes, right? So it's like you really want to be working with someone that is savvy with real estate. And I'm not saying anything negative against CPAs. If it's not their niche, the chances are they're not aware. And it's because they did anything wrong. It's just because of this is fast moving. There's lots of changes that occur. Seems like every year there's something that's moving. And you know, in the tax world. So it's not a criticism. It's just that they may not be aware. And if they're not aware, they're oblivious. Again, you're driving on the toll road.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's funny because I didn't know that you could get to Disney World without a toll road. And that's pretty cool because I'll probably go out of my way and do that.
You can use Google Maps and just click the avoid tolls button now.
There we go. I should probably have known that. But yeah, that's pretty good.
When I started this, you had to know somebody there and you'd say like, hey, is there any way? Cause you remember the little urinal that you threw the quarter in? That was,
yeah.
You know, there's more than once did I get on a darn toll road and I was like, I don't have exact change. And then you had to stand, you'd get in the line or somebody.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I think they still have those in Chicago. Like, and I remember the distinct sound of throwing the change at hitting the backstop and then, you know, falling in and the gate going up or the light going off or whatever it was.
Or you miss and you hear it clang and go underneath the car and you're just like.
Exactly. The almost as a distinctive sound as like the old Snapple drinks in the glass jar, so you'd snap open the top lid, and exactly.
Feeling old.
Well, yeah, okay. The other thing that you've said that I want to make sure people understand is, you know, you talked about residential real estate having certain qualifications, and then you mentioned that VRBO or Airbnb do not fall under that category because they're considered short-term rentals. Can you kind of unpack that? I've actually never heard it said that way. And I've always just assumed that Airbnbs and VRBOs are considered residential property. Can you kind of tell the listeners what you meant by that?
Yeah, because Airbnb and VRBO are not rental activity. Rental activity under the regs, there's some various criteria. But if you have guests that stay on average 7 days or less, so you take a look at the total number of days you rented it during the year and how many people, individual rent arrangements you entered into. So if you're an Airbnb, you know, you're the host, and how many times did you rent to people? Let's say you did 300 days and that was rented, and you rented it to 50 different people or 50 rentals, because the same person could actually rent it twice. But at the end of the day, you're looking at each rental as a separate activity. Then you would be averaging 6 days. And under the regs, which is law, it says 7 days or less is not a rental activity. It's a trade or business. You are a pizza shop. You're a hotel, for lack of a better word. And hotels are non-residential. So Airbnb is non-residential. If your accountant is writing it out, your Airbnb off over 27 and a half years, that's not what they're supposed to be doing. They're supposed to be doing 30 years. So because of that, then there's a new provision under the One Big Beautiful Bill that allows you to write off 100% of qualified improvement property when you fix up a non-residential property. So your Airbnb could actually qualify. So I was actually having a conversation with an accountant on this yesterday, where one of the strategies that they're looking at is, hey, you know, if you have a property that could qualify as an Airbnb or VRBO as a short-term rental, that's why they call it the short-term rental loophole, by the way. If it's non-passive rental activity, then voila, you could actually qualify for the 100% QIP or qualified improvement property. And that's a pretty huge incentive for somebody who has been sitting off, you know, I haven't made a bunch of improvements on this property because my accountant told me I'd have to write it off over a long period of time. And I can't afford to do that. I got a big tax bill to pay. Well, maybe this is going to allow you to do it. You know, I have to put $30,000 into a property, but I get a $30,000 deduction. That might save you, you know, a good chunk of that. And everything's on sale, 25% off, 30% off, 32% off, 50% off for some of you guys. So that's how that works. And again, there's a lot of folks out there spewing misinformation out there, and, you know, on Instagram and TikTok and even on YouTube. But what it looks like, it's the way I always think of it, there's two lanes. There's what could I deduct and how can I use it? And so I'll use another example, Ryan. I'm going to throw you a complete curveball. A lot of people are sitting on appreciated stock, crypto, real estate, and they're givers. And they're always giving to organizations. And they like writing that check for $10,000 or $25,000. It makes them and their spouse feel good. And I'm like, you just gave cash, right? Cash is great. But if I donate an appreciated asset, I get a deduction on its fair market value. So if I have Tesla that I have, you know, Tesla, I think grown, I want to say it's like 100% this year. But let's just say that I bought Tesla a couple years ago and I'm sitting on some gain, $10,000 of gain. If I just donate the Tesla stock, I get a huge deduction. I get to write off the whole thing. But I only paid this much money for it.
It's a big deal.
And that throws people off. Yeah. So
yeah.
For real estate investors, that's a big one. For anybody out there that's a high net worth individual, or you're making money, I would say, you know, 300,000 and above, you're in the pain zone. You're getting, you know, if you're single, I'm just going to look at the tax rates. I always have them floating around here somewhere, but let's just say, yeah, you're single, 2025. $200,000 and above, you're in 32%. If you're married, it's $394,000. you're in the 32% and above. This is stuff that might be appealing to you. And I'll give you a real life example. So I had a friend who's made some mistakes in real estate. They were chasing some things in Orlando when the 2008 hit, you know, so they got caught. And unfortunately, they had talked their mother into putting their property up on some of these loans. And they lost their mom the property.
Oof.
Mom was blind. So this was horrible. So he came to me and he said, is there any chance that you'd help me out here, try to buy the property back? And I said, of course, it's his grandma and, you know, and he's a friend. And I said, let me go see if I can buy it from the bank. And so I went and I bought it from the bank. And I'm not going to use the real numbers, but let's just say it was $100,000. A few years later, that property is worth three times that amount. After, if you remember 2008, we bought it, then everything went up. Long story short is I donated that property to a nonprofit that I actually control. And I just, hey, it's either I'm going to put a bunch of money in it or I'm just going to put this property in it. And I had two goals. One is I didn't want to charge his mom rent, and I had to impute rent to her in the for-profit world. In the nonprofit world, I could write, do a grant and just give her the property, allow her to use it. But that property had gone up triple, and I'm not I could give you the paperwork on it.
Wow.
My deduction and my tax savings was worth more than I paid for the property. And I still have that property to this day. The mom has since passed away, but it's still sitting in that nonprofit and I'm still renting it out to folks. If you're not thinking this way, you're leaving money on the sideline. And you could do this. You don't have to do this the way I did it. Like, you could just say, hey, I have some stocks that appreciated, or I have some crypto, and donate those to a nonprofit. They'll let you roll that directly into the nonprofit and you get a huge deduction. Well, this might solve your tax problem. A lot of these folks are like, man, I'm paying so much in tax and I have to write a check and it's so painful. And I'm like, hey, before the end of the year, look at this stuff. Do I have anything that's highly appreciated that I don't need? I've done this multiple times with real estate. I've done it multiple times with stocks that ran up. I had a stock that I forgot I even had that was
nice.
That was public, and it was a buddy of mine things. And I was like, I'd already written it off in my mind. And I was like, yeah, just donate it. Still there. Cash is still there. I just use it for charitable purposes. But you're already giving the money away. Just look at it a little bit differently and you get these huge benefits.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Now, I wanted to kind of pull on charitable giving a little bit, because I know that some charitable giving stuff, not why we're on the topic of sort of giving and donating, sort of appreciating stock into what we just discussed. What changed with charitable giving this year with the Big Beautiful Tax Bill? Has it gotten better? Has it gotten worse? What do kind of people need to think about, you know, before the end of the year when it comes down to that?
Good question. And there's some complexity there. And I'm not going to, just off the top of my head, I'm not going to be able to hit it all. But they have a small amount that you get to write off above the line where you don't have to do itemized deductions, Schedule A. And the reality is that Schedule A, about 90% of the people are taking the standard deduction. So very few people are actually getting the benefit of charitable donation. So by opening that up and giving you it above the line, that's great. And then they have an amount that is a cap. I shouldn't say cap, but you have to, there's a threshold of a percentage that you can't write off on the charitable giving. So it's a small amount that you have to exceed before you get to write it off. So if somebody is giving a small amount and they barely qualify for the standard deduction, there's a good chance, or excuse me, they exceed the standard deduction, there's a good chance that they're not going to actually get the benefit of that. So usually you want to do these things in big chunks. And again, there's a little bit of complexity there. But what flows through is you're going to have to do the calculation. You're going to grab your account and you're going to say, if I do this, what's the benefit? And I'll tell you something that's been working the last few years that's not going to change. It's going to keep working. And that is using a donor advised fund to stockpile your giving. So some of you guys probably just said, I would never give a house, but they're giving 10% a year of their income. So they're giving $25,000-$30,000 a year. And they're like, but I'd never give a house. Okay, donate your house to a donor advised fund. Take the deduction, the $300,000 deduction this year. And then use that donor advised fund to give your $25,000, $30,000 a year to your charity. It's not you anymore because it's not benefiting you. A lot of you guys, the standard deduction is going to be better anyway. You're at $30,000 standard deduction for a married couple and you're not getting much benefit.
I've never thought of it that way. That's really cool.
Yeah, well, lots of little tweaks out there. That's why you have to hang out with tax nerds.
That's right. Now, now is that something that you've got to do by the end of this year to qualify for 2025? Or how does the timing of something like that, and what goes into setting up a fund like that?
Well, so a donor advised fund, you'd have to make the donation before the end of the year. So this is tax basis or cash basis tax accounting. Like you need to make the gift before December 31st. A donor advised fund, there's every major brokerage house has them. If you are doing your own 501c3 and you want a donor advised fund, you might want to talk to us. We have a whole bunch of donor advised funds empty, just sitting there waiting where you could control it and direct the funds. Otherwise, you're going to like a Schwab or to a Morgan, you're going to be stuck with doing securities. But you want to do the real estate, then you have a couple choices. If you want to control the real estate, then you're going to have to go to a group like us. If you don't, you just want to donate it, then you could go to a number of different organizations. We'll take your real estate off your hand as a donor advised fund.
Yeah, that's great. Well, and if they want to learn more about how to do that, they could probably go to, do they email you? How do people kind of learn more about how to get involved in that?
You just go to Anderson Advisors, or you probably have a link.
Yeah.
I know you guys do a lot of nice things. We teach a class, which you guys always are out at, which is the Tax and Asset Protection live event. My partner, Clint, leads most of that. And I come out there and say hi to people. But we're going over tax and asset protection over 3 days. Everything that you want to know about LLCs, corporations, land trusts, regular living trusts, how to do a legacy plan. You're going to learn about cost segregation while you're there. You're going to learn about tax planning. You're going to learn about things that you can do in real estate. You're going to learn about all these things in that event. And Ryan, you guys always go up and do a great job talking about syndications and how those work and opportunities for folks. And you've done a great job for our clients over a long period of time. I can't remember how long we've been working together. It's been so long.
Almost 10 years. Kind of crazy. Better part of a decade.
Yeah, better part of a decade.
Yeah.
At least, because I remember, gosh.
My son was not born yet when we were at one of the things in Hawaii. So that was like at least 5 years ago.
No, that was longer than 5 years ago, my friend.
Yeah, he's almost six. He turned six in December. Holy cow.
It's been a minute.
It's been a minute. Okay, so Toby, I wanted to get into the next thing, which is, a lot of my deals have built-in refinances, which is really cool. Like my Houston project, as an example, the lender has actually given us what's called an earnout. And I think a lot of investors don't know what this is. It's not a refinance, although we could refinance some of our deals and return capital, but we actually have what's called an earnout. And an earnout is what happens when we hit certain debt service coverage metrics. It's a fancy way of saying, if we performed as we project, then the lender will actually give us an additional $14 million. And the way that works with the, it's really good. It's built in. It's not a refinance fee. It's not an additional payment we have to make or cost or anything like that. It's if we hit our DSCR of 1.35 in year three, they will automatically send back $14 million. And the way that a syndication works is when you have a refinance event, what happens is, depending on how your waterfall is structured, but Spartan waterfalls are pretty much the same. There might be some variability, but generally when there's a refinance event, that means there's a liquidity event and the investors get that money back based on how much basis they have from an investment standpoint in the deal. So at that, in our case, you know, there might be some cash flow up until that point, but eventually they're going to get all that money. They're going to get 100% of that $14 million in that instance that they haven't met their preferred return and things like that. What happens, is that a taxable event, the earnout? And is that any different than a refi?
I'll just answer it this way, because there is some complexity there depending on whether they're at risk. But if they're just receiving back the money that they invested, that is not taxable. If you borrow money against a property and you're at risk, it is not taxable. With your situation, I imagine that the LPs and the investors are not on the hook. So as long as it's not in excess of the amount that they invested and they're receiving that, you know, then they have basis and they would not have a taxable event. It would be tax-free.
That's a really good clarification. Yeah, the plan is to send back about 24% of their initial investment. And by that point, they maybe were cash flowing 4-6% per year. So no, they would still have a basis. So that would, to your point, come back as a tax-free event. And we've done that. We've actually done like refinances. We're getting ready to refinance another portfolio and send back 50% of the investor's cash. But here's the thing, to your point, we've already sent them back over 100% of their basis in that deal. So what you're telling me is that refinance event will be a taxable event for them. Is that right?
Yeah. If you receive funds in excess of your basis, it's generally going to be long-term capital gains. It's been held over a year. The other thing is, when you say the earnout, if they're giving you money, like here's just free cash, there's a taxable event. But if it's here's additional monies that you're borrowing and it's getting added to your loan, then it is not.
It's the latter. It's part of the loan. They're increasing the loan size as a...
I was assuming that, but I didn't want to... When there's accountants that listen to these things and they're like, oh, they gave you... It's compensation then. You know, they gave you money back. It's a refund. You know, it's a rebate, which could be taxable. And it's like, okay, I don't think that's what this was, but I just want to make sure.
All right, I have two questions specific to deals that we've done in the past. So we bought a ground-up development project, raw land in Georgia in, call it 2024, early 2024, and we're almost finished building a self-storage facility. It's in Port Wentworth, Georgia. It should probably open next month. So it'll open in 2025. Do investors get 100% bonus depreciation because it entered service in 2025? Or do they get the reduced amount because we bought the raw land in 2024? What do they get, the better benefit of depreciation? Or
I believe it's purchased and put into service. So in this particular case, it'd be put into service. So you'd get the lesser amount of when it was put into service, which I believe would be the 40%.
The 40%. Okay.
Yeah, that amount would be 100% deductible, even though it was only in service for a short period of time. When you do bonus depreciation, it doesn't matter whether it's in December or, you know, it was in January. The amount is the same.
Gotcha.
For that deduction. For the straight line deduction, like when you're writing things off over the 39 year, that will matter that it was put into service at the end of the year.
Okay, excellent. Thanks for that clarification. Yeah, and so we also are doing ground up construction. We bought land in March of this year. And we're building a self-storage facility that will enter service next year. And my understanding is that when we enter it into service in 2026, this is the Bellingham project we're doing, that one will receive 100% bonus depreciation when we enter it into service for the tax year 2026. Do I have that right?
Yeah, 2026 would be 100%, but as long as it was purchased and put into service after the threshold deadline for the one big beautiful building.
Yeah, and the deadline was basically the day that Trump took office, right? Isn't that how he basically wrote that
January date? January 19th, 2025.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. I wish that they had just not done that. Like it's confused the heck out of people, but there's, you know, people that bought properties, fixed them up, put them into service in 2025, and they're spiking the football going 100% bonus. And you're like,
We kind of talked earlier about things that you've got to do by the end of the year, which is if you have a passive gain, you have to buy something by the end of the year or invest in a syndication by the end of the year to take advantage of that. What are some things that people still have time to do even after the new year?
All right. So there's huge ones. Like if you're reimbursing yourself on expenses and things like that, your cash basis, you need to get the money back for those things can be deducted. So if you have real estate that you're running yourself, please make sure that some of these expenses that they're paid before the end of the year, because that's how you deduct them. Something else to always think about, just to get tax nerd on you, is if you're receiving rents and you're in a high tax bracket, you may want to, in this year's bad, but next year you think you're going to have some properties come online that would give you some tax relief. You tell people, don't pay me in December, pay me in January, because then your receipt of those rents would actually be taxable in 2026. So So there's those little games you could play too. But to get back to what you're talking about, there are things that you could do after the fact. One of the things you can do after the fact is cost segregation. You don't have to do the cost segregation in 2025 to get benefit for it during the calendar year. You could actually do that cost seg right up until you file your tax return. So you could do the cost seg next year on properties. And we do this all the time. You find out usually in the summer after the tax, like for 2024, we were doing our tax analysis mostly during the summer of 2025, right? Do I have a tax liability? Is there anything I could do? Okay, maybe I could accelerate depreciation on this property or this one, and I could offset. Is there positive cash flow on these? You really don't necessarily know until several months after the tax year because you're waiting for K-1s. You're tying up your accounting at the end of the year. You're doing all these things. You could pull that trigger on a cost seg. Get this. This is going to freak some people out. You can actually do it after you sold a property.
Really?
As long as you can get access to it.
Wow.
A lot of people don't realize there's something called a 1245 exchange where when you do bonus depreciation, that property, when you sell it, is ordinary income tax. And so there's an incentive to reduce the value of that property when you do a sale. So sometimes people haven't done a cost seg at all and they don't even realize that they're getting this recapture on a huge amount. They didn't get, and there's not a lot of value in what they're selling. Like, think about carpeting. I was writing off carpeting over 39 years and I just sold it. Now I'm recapturing all that I wrote it off as though there's value in that carpeting. There really isn't. So if you could do a cost seg after, and I was thinking of one situation, it saved about $80,000 on the sale of an apartment unit. And they did it after the sale. They just had to get access to the property to do it. And it's one of those things that's permanent tax savings. It's like, if it costs you $10,000 to save 20, I'm doing it. If it's permanent. You know, a lot of folks, when they're doing cost segs, they're like, oh, I need to get a really big incentive because all you're doing is accelerating the bonus or the depreciation into the first year. When you do and you're getting rid of a property and you can save yourself on taxes, that's permanent. It doesn't come back at you at all. So there's those. And then if you're in small businesses, there's things like you can still do 401ks and defined benefit plans after the end of the year. You can make employer contributions to some of these things. But I don't think that's necessarily what you're asking about. I think if the calling of your stuff is, what are things we can do even with real estate after the fact? Do we have to pull the trigger on some of these things this year? No. You can look at it and you could say, I'll use real life examples. Just use me as an example. Clint and I, we own hundreds of properties. And we're pretty good at doing projections, but sometimes we're off a little bit and you'll have $100,000 or $200,000, whatever it is, that's hitting you of passive income and you're like, nuts. And I don't qualify as a real estate professional because, you know, I do law and tax way more, right? If you guys know what the rules are for real estate professional, you know, I'm not one and my wife's not a real estate professional. So we don't qualify, Clint or I. So what we always do is we look at our bunch of our properties and we say, are there unlocked deductions in any of those properties that if I do a cost seg, and I break it into its components that I can accelerate and take an offset and avoid paying tax on that income. And the answer has been yes, repeatedly over the years. And it just depends on what the rules are in any particular year. Sometimes it's 40% depreciation, 60% depreciation, 100% bonus, 80% bonus. Like all these things are laying around out there. The One Big Beautiful Bill just made it really simple because they said 100% going forward, permanent. So unless Congress changes that rule, we're for the foreseeable future looking at a very positive economic environment for tax on real estate. And I think that's one of the reasons why you see real estate being absurdly resilient when everybody's screaming about it's overpriced, everything needs to correct. And it's like, yeah, no, I just looked at for residential, I just looked year over year and it's up 1.5%. Again, everybody's screaming it's going to get killed. And all these markets are getting hammered. It's like, yeah, it's pretty resilient right now. The value is not going down. And inflation, they're going to have to print a lot of cash to pay the, we're still running at about a $2 trillion a year deficit That's a lot of cash that's going to get printed. So it's going to keep assets going up. So if you're not holding assets, you're just holding cash, you're going to get smacked around a little bit. But anyway, I hope I answered your question in a roundabout way.
Absolutely. I think that's critical. Well, Toby, I really appreciate you coming on today and sharing some things that you can do this year and some things that you can do in the next year. I'm actually, you know, the class that you mentioned that you teach on taxes, asset protection, things like that is actually coming up, and it's coming up in December of this year. And I know that you guys do them every quarter, so there's always an opportunity to go. But the one that's coming up is actually in Dallas, from my understanding. Is that right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're going to be there. That's December 4th through the 6th in Dallas, Texas. And anybody who's listening to the show here, listening to our webinar, if you want to email me, ryan@spartan-investors.com, you can get a free ticket. I've only got, I think, 15 or so free tickets. So the first 15 people that reach out to me, I can give a free ticket to the event. I'm going to be there personally. My Spartan team is going to be there. Toby is going to be there. And it's 3 days of jam-packed information about tax and legal planning, how to save taxes, how to position yourself to do it. There's a ton of real estate tips. But I think what I get the most out of that event personally, because I've been to it a bunch of times and I've learned a lot, is the conversations that happen with my fellow real estate or investing peers that happen in the hallway. You know, I hear what other people are doing and how they've benefited or where they're looking for properties or how they've done things that Anderson has suggested they do to position themselves for success. So I think the networking has been phenomenal. And, you know, we go out for dinners every night when we're there with investors, and super fun event just overall. And you get FaceTime with Toby and Clint and things like that. So it's a really great event. If you want to go, if you want more information about it, you can reach out to me via email. But Toby, I know you have a YouTube channel that you put a lot of amazing content on. If you can't make the conference, tell me a little bit about your YouTube channel.
Yeah, well, it's everything financial and tax, and I even throw in some health stuff in there, health, wealth, just because it's near and dear to my heart, no pun intended, but some of you guys know I've had some issues. So I share some things there, but it's a pretty robust channel. But if you want to know about finances, if you want to know about money, if you want to know about what people are doing, just because we do over 10,000 tax returns a year, so I know what investors are doing just from my own clientele, plus folks like you, Ryan. And we share it all on YouTube. I think 2 or 3 times a week, I put out new videos, and you can join it. Just type in Toby Mathis and YouTube and you'll find me.
That's great. Well, thanks so much, Toby, for your time. And thanks for those that have tuned in. We'll catch you on the next one.